So I'd like to look first at Ephesians chapter 4. And this is a very obviously well-known passage in regard to equipping the saints. But as I read it, I want us to see this the progression that's in place that comes from equipping the saints. Let's see, let me find, I'm going to start reading in verse 11. Ephesians 4, verse 11. So Christ himself gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the pastors, and teachers to equip his people for works of service so that the body of Christ may be built up until we all reach unity in the faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God and become mature, obtaining to the whole measures of the fullness of Christ. That's quite a progression, isn't it? He has these leaders in the church that he's raised up, pastors and teachers at the end there specifically, to equip his people for what? For works of service, so that the body of Christ may be built up until we all reach unity in the faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God and become mature. There's this progression that takes place as a result of equipping all the saints for the work of the ministry. That's our lay leaders. That's the main people that we would want to focus on to be able to then build up the body of Christ through their what? Works of service, that it leads to these other things. Turn to Titus chapter 2 with me. Titus chapter 2, just a few books over. And Titus 1, as we kind of referenced yesterday, Titus 1 is Paul writing to Titus, and then he gives similar qualifications of an elder there in the first half. And by the way, Paul's writing to Titus, his young pastoral protege, to establish what remains and to appoint elders in every city. That's the very first part of chapter 1, and then he goes on to explain who should be elders. And then the second half of chapter 1 is, here's who the elders are supposed to protect the church from. And he calls them the rebellious men. So Paul's writing to Titus, and chapter 1 is about elders. He's been commanded to set up, or instructed to set up, these new churches in Crete, or finish establishing these new churches in Crete. And Paul starts with who are supposed to be the pastors, who leads the church. It's a good place to start. You probably could agree. And then what they're to do. And then chapter 2 gets into the role of everyone else in these churches in Crete. And that's where I want to read. Chapter 2, I'm going to read all of the chapter and then just make a few observations from it to just help us see that God has a role, a specific role for every single person in your church who knows Jesus. It's part of walking with Jesus and following Jesus to be a part of a local church and to play a role for the church to thrive. So let me read chapter 2, starting verse 1, Titus chapter 2. This is Paul writing to Titus. He says, "You, however, must teach what is appropriate to sound doctrine. Teach the older men to be temperate, worthy of respect, self-controlled, and sound in faith, in love, and in endurance. Likewise, teach the older women to be reverent in the way they live, not to be slanderers or addicted to much wine, but to teach what is good. Then they can urge the younger women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled and pure, and to be busy at home, to be kind, and to be subject to their husbands, so that no one will malign the word of God. Similarly, encourage the young men to be self-controlled. In everything, set them an example by doing what is good. In your teaching, show integrity, seriousness, and soundness of speech that cannot be condemned, so that those who oppose you may be ashamed because they have nothing bad to say about us. Teach slaves to be subject to their masters in everything, to try to please them, not to talk back to them, and not to steal from them, but to show that they can be fully trusted, so that in every way they will make the teaching about God our Savior attractive. For the grace of God has appeared that offers salvation to all people, It teaches us to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in this present age, while we wait for the blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us from all wickedness and to purify for himself a people that are his very own, eager to do what is good. These, then, are the things you should teach. Encourage and rebuke with all authority. Do not let anyone despise you. Titus 2 can be divided up into two parts. The first is verses 1 through 10. Take your eyes there. Did you notice the list that existed there? Titus chapter 2, verses 1 through 10 are the different categories of people that Titus is to instruct in their particular role. Now, there is an important observation to make here. Titus, Paul is not writing to Titus and describing the different kinds of churches that should exist. In other words, he's not talking about having like just a one generation church. He's not addressing churches that just have older men or a church that just has younger women. He's assuming when he writes this, you notice he didn't preface it with anything. He assumes in these new churches that are being set up in Crete, he's assuming there's multiple generations. He's assuming there's men and women in all these churches. He's assuming there are slaves and masters and that complicated relationship in the first century in every church. And 1 through 10 lists the categories and then the roles they are to play. The second part of Titus 2 is verses 11 through 15. Look there with me. This is the gospel of Jesus Christ that empowers these different categories to be able to do what they have been instructed to do. In other words, what happens if you take a bunch of people from different generations and a bunch of people who are different from each other and you stick them all in the same church? What's going to happen? Usually bad things if we just leave them to ourselves. The only way you can bring old and young and men and women and bondservants and masters together is through the power of Christ at work in every single person that's in that church. I work with a ton of churches that are just one generation. It's interesting. I work with two main kinds of churches, and they're all over the world. They're kind of an old historic church, been around a long, long time, and it's in decline. Many of you have walked into those kind of churches, and they are typically made up of one generation. It's typically the older generation. And then there's other kind of churches that I work with. One is a church plant, a newer church that a lot of times has younger folks in it who are trying to go and plant a church and reach a city for Christ in that particular place or a town or a village. And they plant a church with the aim to do that, but they are typically made up of the younger generation. And it's fascinating, as I work with both of these churches, they all agree on something. They believe the hindrance to the ministry they want to accomplish is the other one. And that's where there's a lot of single generation churches that exist around the world. And I'm convinced that Titus chapter 2 is presenting a very different model. See, what Titus 2 is showing us, it's arguably the most stunning example of what God's design is for every local church in every country, culture, context, and century. It's the same design everywhere. Do you see the categories? There's old and young. There's old and young. And they all play different kinds of roles. There's men and women. By the way, that you realize this is scandalous for Paul to write this way. Because women were treated as second-class citizens until the first century when the church came along. What Paul is implying here is that men and women in the church are of equal value. And I think that's important for us to try to capture. Even though there may be different roles in our churches, women are just as important as men in our churches and just as valuable and have just as important a role for the church to thrive. Take your eyes to verses 9 and 10. This category of slaves and masters, really no modern equivalent. I think the closest thing to it is kind of a boss-employee type relationship. There's authority embedded in that relationship. You see that in the kind of instruction it gives. But there's a lot of complexities around this particular relationship. There were prejudices built into this. There was socioeconomic differences into this. I think here's the point in verses 9 to 10 being there. Without it, verses 1 through 8 point to men and women and old and young. But verses 9 and 10 basically covers almost every other aspect of diversity that we would want to see in our churches. Here's the point, I believe, in verses 9 and 10. The rich and the poor were all supposed to be in the same church together. The somebodies and the nobodies of society, they're all supposed to be in the same church together, serving one another. The least of these, the greatest of these, are supposed to be in the same church. So what happens when you take old and young and men and women and this, that complicated relationship of bond servants and masters? It will be an absolute mess unless the transforming power of the gospel is at work to bring everyone together. And I believe that's why verses 11 through 15 have to be here as well. Because look, it says he gives the category and their particular role that they are to play. And notice the role in general is that the older are to teach and mentor the younger. The younger are to learn from and care for the older. That's the design. Makes sense that that would be the design. I know a lot of our churches are not set up that way, but I didn't write this. This is what we should be pursuing and see the model in this. But it's clear that that's the role, whether men or women. The older are to seek and mentor the younger are to learn from and care for the older. That's going to be really tricky. How is that going to happen? How are bondservants and masters going to be in the same church and want to even love and serve one another? Look at verse 11. The only reason is, for the grace of God has appeared. That's the only way that this can happen. That somehow people would come together and serve and sacrifice and love one another in the same church that's different from each other. And also look at verse 11. For the grace of God has appeared that offers salvation to all people. The context, I think, can allow us to say it this way. The grace of God has appeared that offers salvation to all kinds of different people. The grace of God, the salvation that comes through Christ, it's for everyone. And it's powerful enough to unite all these differences that we would find in our churches. Why is this important? Well, I think, one, this highlights the design of the local church anyway. I don't have to know about your church to know that this is supposed to be the design of your church. Now, it would also depend on what the reflection of your community is. So that certain diversity in a church, we can seek the diversity, but it's obviously going to be reflective of who's around your church, who's available to be a part of your church. So it's going to look different in every place. The point is that the design of the local church is that anybody would be welcomed into your church if they walked in. Is that true? Well, if anybody walks through the doors of your church, would they be loved and received and welcomed? That was actually, the church I took had some significant prejudices of different groups. Our church was all older and white. And there were significant hostilities and prejudices towards other races and ethnicities and nationalities in our church, which I did not discover until I got there. And one of the signs I saw God was at work was that people would walk through the door who were different from others, and they were loved and received and cared for. And I would encourage you to look for that mark as well. Not necessarily how many people you have or how much money you have, but is this model being reflected? If you have multiple generations in your church, but it's 15 people, God's at work. God's at work. It's not about how many people, it's about who's there. What's the makeup of your church? That's one of the evidences. And not just that, but are people playing the role that Paul is describing to Titus to instruct to these different groups in these new churches that are being set up? And it's only possible through the power of the gospel, which is verses 11 through 15. The reason I want to come here is that it shows that every single person has a role in your church. This text is so helpful because you're either old or young. You get to pick which category you're in, by the way. I just turned 50 last month. So I'm kind of confused on where I fall now. I always claim to be old in the younger until I turn, but I'm still young at heart. Maybe that's what I'll go with. Where do you fall? Old or young? Obviously, men, women. But also just even the complexity of diversity that exists from verses 9 and 10. The reason this passage is important for us today is, one, it does show God's design for the church that a lot of times is not the design that we pursue or understand is the point. But the other reason is that as you are trying to equip lay leaders in your church to play different roles, we need to start this morning knowing, regardless on who it is, every single member in your church has a role to play. And you need to know what that is. And that's the starting place to help shepherd them and care for them and to know what their particular role is. So Ephesians 4 reminds us that the leaders are to equip the saints for the work of the ministry. And here we find that every single person, it doesn't matter if you're old or young, or man or woman, it doesn't matter. We all have a part to play. And I want to use that to kind of spring into some of the practicalities of how do we begin to equip lay leaders. And a little bit of review, since we've all slept since we last met together. Two categories we established last night between the offices of pastor, elders, deacons. And that's shepherding category, service category. And we're going to flesh those out today on where do we place lay leaders in those two categories, and then how do we train them to be able to do the work that we want them to do. It's kind of the plan of where we want to go. And again, we're going to have Q&A and all kinds of things to talk about around that. All right? I do want to jump into a little bit of this, and then we'll go ahead and pause and then go to some Q&A and have some time around that. So let me give you some categories around shepherding and service. I'm pulling up my phone because I have a note on here I'm going to look at. I'm not checking Twitter, I promise. Okay. So shepherding and service. And what I want to be able to do is I want to give you categories. I know that's, a lot of us are thinking, okay, so what counts as shepherding? What counts as service? My hope is as I give you these categories, then people are going to leap to your mind and go, oh yeah, they're in this category. Okay. Oh yeah, they're in this category. And a lot of times, I don't know, this is how my mind works, at least. We can place people in different buckets and go, oh, you go here, and then I'll know how to help you and train you in this and encourage you to be able to step into this work. Otherwise, we don't have categories in our minds of where this fits. I don't know, it becomes just kind of a jumbled mess a lot of times, and we don't know how to articulate to a layperson how I need you to help us lead. And so the clarity around it is the key, which is why, again, I want to start with the offices of the New Testament and how lay leadership flows from that, even though not everybody will be called a deacon, not everybody will be called an elder. So I want to start with the shepherding category. Here are some categories. I'm going to give you the categories, and then we're going to walk through them throughout the morning. But I want to just give you a heads up. So if you're writing these, if you're taking notes, I want to give them all to you so you can see the list and how they fit together as a whole. Shepherding. I got five categories I want to give you here and five categories of service. And then we'll begin to break those down the rest of our time. So shepherding. First category is word. The ministry of the word. That is under the category of shepherding, because it's caring for the souls of people. Remember, shepherding is caring for people's souls. The ministry of the word is the central way that any of us can do that. It's the primary way we shepherd people's souls publicly in the church. So the ministry of the word, that is a key point of shepherding, whether it's preaching on Sunday morning or whether it's reading the Bible to somebody who's in the hospital. That's a ministry of the word. That's shepherding people's souls. And plenty of people can do that in your church who's not an elder. or a pastor. So word is number one. Category number two in shepherding is prayer. It's prayer. By the way, my hope is as we go through these categories, you'll be amazed at when we hit these categories, you'll think, man, everybody in my church could technically lead in that way if they would step up and do it. You're right if you would think that way. Number two is prayer. Can we agree? Anybody can have a ministry of prayer in the church. I mean, literally anybody. And by the way, one of the things when I look at Titus 2 and I see the role that older men and women are supposed to play to the younger, I had some amazing older saints that I got a chance to pastor and to get to know and learn from. So as you hear my story too, it's important you realize we're talking three or four families mainly that just held a stranglehold on the church and led those charges to fire me and to come after me. So it wasn't an old and young thing. I had all kinds of older saints in the church that were always with me, were supportive, were praying for me and caring for me. So it's just, I want to make sure you understand that it was not an old, young thing. A lot of people can make that out that way, especially in a church revitalization context. Prayer is something that anybody can do. And one of the things that older members taught me, one of the reasons they struggled with seeing the church change, they're the ones that had been there 50 years. They were the ones that led all the ministries and served in all kinds of ways. They were the lay leaders of the church. And all of a sudden they got too old to the point that they could not physically do what they always had done. And they didn't know where they fit. They didn't know what to do with that. By the way, just side note to make note of. Sometimes the cliche of the grumpy old people at church, it's not necessarily because they're just grumpy. It's because they're hurting. It's because they don't know their place. They did this one thing for 40 years, and now I'm 80, I'm 90. I have no idea how I can serve the church. And they don't know what to do about it. And so the last thing they want to see happen is you change anything, even if you show them in the Bible that you should. To make note of that, just in general, about older members, but I bring that up because one of the things that this helped me think about with the older members who physically could not serve the church like they once did is they clearly have a role to mentor and teach the younger. So even though they can't physically lead the ministries they once did, they can do that. And they can pray till their dying breath, last breath. And so can anybody in your church. And that is a shepherding category. So prayer, word, prayer, number three. This is one category I'm putting, even though it could be two, but the sick and the grieving. Caring for the sick and the grieving in particular. And there are texts in the New Testament that point specifically to that. The need to care for the sick, the need to care for the grieving. We're gonna look at a bit of that. But I'm putting that in the same category because you're talking about people who are either facing death or difficulties from health, or those who are dealing with the loss of a loved one through death. That is a unique opportunity to shepherd someone's soul that a lot of people can do if they're willing. Number four, widows, widow care. It's amazing how it's one of the few categories in the New Testament that are actually specifically highlighted by the Apostle Paul as that needs particular care. And they're some of the most forgotten people in our churches because they don't fight for our time like other people do. And they just sit in their homes, in their assisted livings, and don't clamor for our attention. And they sit there alone and isolated so often. But all kinds of people can be trained to do widow care. We're going to talk about that. Number five, last one on the shepherding side is the weaker brothers and sisters. The weaker brothers and sisters. We got to be careful. We've established we're all weak. Earlier in the conference, we're all weak. But there is a clear category in the New Testament of that's called the weaker brethren. Find it in 1 Corinthians, you find it in Romans. It's there. And those of us who are in leadership in our churches in different ways already probably know who those people are. And we're going to talk about those people. How do we know who they are? And how do we care for them in particular? And how can lay leaders play a part in that? But this there's a clear category in the New Testament. They need to be cared for, but a lot of times that requires more time and energy to care for the weaker brothers and sisters in the church, which means we have to raise up lay leaders to help with that. We cannot do that by ourselves as a pastor and a pastor's wife. That's a lot of times what happens is one person ends up caring for some of the more difficult people to care for in the church. And that's a crucial place for lay leaders to be raised up to be able to serve. So there's the five for shepherding, okay? So I hope you got columns or something on your notes you're making. Word, prayer, sickness, grieving, widows, the weaker, brothers and sisters, okay? Now over here, the service side. Here are the categories for service. Five of them as well, because I need a little balance in my life, you know? But they all start with B, if that helps. Given how my mind works a bit. Building. Building. Whether you have an actual church building that's old and falling apart and you're constantly somebody needs to take care of it, or you're a church plant setting up in a building every single Sunday morning, that counts as building. Somebody's got to take care of the facilities and the place where your church is. So think physical structure, building, okay? Number two is budget. Budgets. Someone's got to take care of the money. Someone's got to write up all the budgets and things and know where the money goes and keep good records. Nothing will destroy a church more than a reputation that you cannot appropriately handle the money that the people give. Was it here that I shared $1 million. Okay. Everything's kind of running together, guys. Sorry. All right. Yeah. So just imagine what that did to the church. And it's like, that's all you need is to hear a story like it to go, oh yeah, we should take care of the money. Somebody's got to do that kind of grinding work. That's a service to the church. Okay. So building, budget, number three, body. Body. That's pointing to the physical needs of the congregation. So there's an elderly widow who can't get out and she needs food. It's caring for a physical need. Somebody needs help with something. I mean, just think about all the different physical needs to meet basic needs in the congregation. That's caring for the body. Okay. Number four is borders. Borders. That is talking about, in a sense, the security and safety of the church when they are at the place that you meet. So think borders. Think how are we conducting ourselves as a church on the property that we're on that assures safety and organization and caring for people well while they're there. So, I mean, children's ministry would be a classic example of that. What things do you have in place to make sure the people who are taking care of the children in your nursery and children's ministry are safe? You know, to care for those kids in that way. That's this may not be as much of an issue here, but you all probably hear about church shootings that take place in America. This is actually a real thing in our churches that we have to be mindful of. I remember the time where someone actually came to me and asked me about that. There had been some church shootings in the news. There are different parts of America that feel more like the Wild West than others, but nonetheless, it's something that, ironically, I had a church member move here from Texas, and he's the one that asked me about it, so I thought that's appropriate. But it was an important thing because we were in a very urban, dense area, the south end of Louisville, that had a lot of crime and violence, and It's something you have to think about when there is the potential of somebody to walk in and start shooting in the church. So borders, it's a security aspect to it, not just though in regard to things like that, but just are people safe? Do people know where to go? Do people know all those kinds of things, directional things in the church? That's borders, okay? Number five, and I'm not sure which appropriate term to use, but I think it's bums. It's butts at home. Where do people sit and meet? I left a pause just to see if you knew what I was going to go with that. You think about the places set, you know, set up in a sense. Chairs, pews, keeping up with the places where we all gather and meet as a church. That's, depending on your church, that is a big part of service in the church. I mean, if you've ever been a part of a church planting team, you're with me. I mean, every Sunday morning, spending maybe a couple of hours going to have to set up just so we have a place to sit and meet and gather together. So it's kind of that can fall under buildings in a way, but it's specifically, the building is taking care of the actual property. This is taking care of and the people who would serve in the actual public gathering in the different places that you would meet as a church. So there's five B's. I'm going to stop there. We're going to get into these, the rest of that, but this is where we're headed. And I want to be able to talk about each one of these and then think about practically how do we equip people for these areas and how do we identify the best people to serve in those areas, and then also just let you ask questions around that. But I'm going to pause and let you just ask some questions now, if you have any. Thank you.
This is possibly in relation to last night and authority, but see what you think. So I was an elder before I was a pastor, and coming into full-time pastoral ministry, I was completely comfortable with the idea that in a church that's anything larger than, you know, 30 people, that realistically people are going to have a stronger relationship with one or other of the different elders. And that's a strength. You know, one elder knows certain members of the congregation better, and hopefully there's formal or informal groups. I was completely comfortable with that. That's a strength. But in relation to wounded sheep, discovered that it's quite possible dynamically for a wounded sheep to start playing off leaders against each other and creating cracks between them. So should I, as a church, by God's grace, continues to grow, really try and have a strong, direct relationship as pastor with everybody? Or is that working against that model of multiple eldership?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question. So I think if you have elders, okay, I would say that it doesn't matter if there's 10 people. If you have elders, all elders should be a part of the shepherding process of sheep. I think overlap is a great thing. But you want to make sure at least all the sheep are cared for by at least one elder. So obviously if you're a solo pastor, you're taking care of everybody. But yeah, I think the goal is just to make sure everybody is cared for appropriately, whatever that standard and bar is for you as a church. But yeah, I found, and I think you also have to assume there's going to be some people who slip through the cracks. And so almost creating a system of overlap among elders is kind of a more of a foolproof way to prevent that to happen. Yeah. So to answer your question, yeah, I mean, we get more deeper into that, but that's, yeah, I just think that's ideal because, and that's the thing, the elders and the deacons have to lead by example. So I think every elder should be shepherding in some form or fashion. Every deacon should be serving in some, and it's the essence of what they're supposed to be doing. And so when we move to elders, the bar we set is if you become an elder in our church, you have to shepherd, be involved in shepherding in some way, even with the limited time you have. And you have to be a part of the ministry of the word in the church in some way. It doesn't even have to be public preaching, but just ministry of the word. Because that's the two main tasks, I think, of shepherding souls. And so every elder, before we even affirmed them, knew that was the expectation. And the church knew, like, we have to see this person as gifted in that way. And then what we would do is among the elders, we would look at the different, unique skill sets we all had, or even a lack of gifting in certain areas. And then we would appropriately give other tasks to them. But it started with shepherding, soul, caring for souls, ministry of the word. When we set that expectation, then that automatically means every elder is going to be involved in shepherding to some degree, even though I was involved in the overwhelming majority of shepherding tasks because I was the full-time pastor. I was the only paid pastor. And so naturally, I'm going to end up doing more of that. So because that was the setup, we ended up creating a system where I basically was trying to make some kind of effort to connect with every church member in some way. And then we would task them shepherding tasks with other people based on what the need was. Did more time need to be spent? Those kind of things. Yeah.
Brian, we're comfortable talking about character and competency. We've got the scriptures to guide us in terms of character, competency. We can see we're measuring. Thinking about chemistry in a team, and chemistry is obviously a lot harder for us to measure than character and competency, mm-hmm. but also aware that if we have a need for, if we're looking to grow an eldership, if we're looking to grow a diaconate, we want the right people in these places that serve alongside. What's your thoughts on how do we... We're looking to appoint good people, but we need them to be able to work within teams that are established. How do you begin to measure and look at chemistry within your kind of leadership structure?
Yeah, thanks, John. I'm glad you asked that because I think chemistry does matter. And at the same time, I think we have to be mindful of what we have to choose from. So I think that's also where you set the bar on what qualifies as an elder, what qualifies as a deacon in your church is going to be different every place. They need to qualify biblically according to what your conscience is comfortable with. But depending on how many people you have to choose from, depending on, how called and gifted people are, how much time they can give. I mean, I know people who are just dying, if they can just find one man that could be a lay elder with them, they would jump at that opportunity if they had that. So, and in my case, for many years, once we moved to elders, because we were training so many, men for pastoral ministry, we usually had guys we were constantly looking at. I know that was very rare for us for a church our size, but that was kind of one of the places we were rich in. So chemistry does matter, and yet what I think matters more is that the office is filled appropriately with people. And the hope is that if you're an elder, there's a spiritual maturity there that allows you to figure out how to get along and work together. Yeah.
Thanks very much for that. It was very helpful. Yeah. Can I ask you about the categories for shepherding?
Yeah.
So the first two feel like a what, and the next three are who, ministry of the word, prayer. I'm just a kind of question about the categories you've got under the who, as in it feels like you could have other categories there biblically. So 2 Timothy 2, look for able and reliable people that you can train up for leadership.
Yep.
Presumably that falls under ministry of the word rather than a kind of separate who. I guess it's just a question about where would you see training falling under here, and particularly the training of shepherds for the church.
Yeah, I appreciate that. There's other categories. But the reason I chose these is I believe these are not only, let me say this first. The first two, I see how they fall into category of what, but I would make an argument they also fall into category of who. I mean, who are you praying for? So I think these are the areas that I think are the core of caring for people's souls. And I would add, these are the categories that I believe that a majority of the congregation could be raised up to do. Training leaders, I would say is probably comes more from elders training elders, potential elders, current deacons training other deacons. So yeah, who are obviously certain lay leaders. So yeah, the training and raising up of others in the church is definitely something that would be is a part of the shepherding task. I would definitely agree with that. That's not a role that the overwhelming majority of lay leaders, I think, could play in the church. That's kind of why I didn't put it in there, but. It's a good observation. Yeah, I'm with you. It's shepherding for sure. Someone else. Oh,
Thanks so much. It's really helpful. Can we just give a bit of colour to, in the service category, you've got the body. This is just an area which, in our church, it's a lot fuzzier than the other of the five categories. And that might be because some needs are kind of emergent, so it's harder to perhaps, you know you need to do church financial accounts in a year, but you don't know what's going to come up in the weeks ahead. What could it look like practically to have someone appointed to do that role? I know it does matter a lot on context, but give us some examples, you know, does it work through your small groups or is it best to be centralized? How do you get people who aren't on staff doing that, who don't know the nitty gritty of what's going on in the church? If you could speak into that, it'd be really helpful.
Yeah, sure. So again, body, think physical needs. So, and I think categories of, you know, we read through the New Testament, you see all kinds of physical needs that exist in the church that the church is called upon to meet. So everything from, I mean, food, clothing, shelter, those physical needs that church members may not always have, that that somebody needs to lead and either provide caring for that need or rallying other people to care for that need. So, and I hesitate to say do it this way. I think even as you ask the question, you're thinking well through what's the best way to do this. But take a small group, for example. Okay, so let's say there's an elderly widow that has physical limitations and there's certain things that she cannot do on a regular basis that somebody needs to do for her. Her family lives far away. There's nobody who's there caring for her. And according to 1 Timothy 5, it's the church's responsibility to care for that widow. So for a small group to kind of adopt that widow, and then that small group leader essentially becomes the leader of caring for that widow. And then, so think of the small group that takes that, but then there's a deacon that's kind of overseeing that aspect of the service because it's a category of service and physical need. Well, all of a sudden, what have we done? We just involved, what, six people, eight people in the care of that one widow, and the responsibility gets spread out. So that's one way to do it. Or, depending on how you're set up, if you have a board of deacons that all serve, then the deacons as a whole maybe potentially are the ones facilitating the care for three or four widows that would fall into that category. So if you're thinking through it well, it's just a matter, every church is going to be different. It depends on the people you have. It depends on who's willing to step up, who's got a heart for that kind of work. But the body side of service is focused on the physical needs, because the spiritual side of caring for that widow is shepherding and is going to kind of fall in this other category.
Brian, could you speak into, I suppose we might call it communication, which could, you know, could go into loads of different areas, but we live in a highly digital age where so much is sent out, and so much damage can be done on behalf of the church, perhaps through things that are posted. Where you see that falling under the shepherding and service categories, and how you would oversee that practically within a church?
Yeah. You're right, though. Technology has made it interesting and helpful and complicated too, you know. So I think what, in my mind, technology in the church is something that, I mean, a tech person can kind of be responsible for as far as the workings of it. Honestly, I think content becomes a shepherding thing. So I would not want any communication to go out on behalf of the church to where anybody, you know, a Facebook post or whatever, without elders having oversight over that. Because, yeah, I think it's a spiritual, think content is generally going to be a part of teaching and in discipling and instructing. And so it falls in a shepherding category. It falls under a word category, I think, more than anything. So I think there's a balance in that. And I've seen that work really well. So the last thing you want is a really sharp tech person who kind of goes rogue on you occasionally. That's not the person you want running your tech. You almost want a really fearful tech person who's really skilled. And they don't want to post anything without you signing off on it. That's probably a bit more of a safer model. That, yeah. Yeah.
The way you answered the question about training, about 2 Timothy 2, answered my question as well on church discipline, which I felt was a real shepherding thing that didn't appear in the list. But the way you answered it suggested that what we're dealing with here, what you've covered, is stuff that we might be training lay leaders for, and you haven't covered things that might be more exclusive to kind of appointed elders. Is that the case? And could you just clarify whether there are things that you, whether there are more elements of the shepherding role that are more exclusive to those in office, like training or church discipline or anything else? Yeah.
Yeah, I appreciate you asking that. Yes, there are. So I would have a bigger list for elders on the shepherding side. Church discipline would be one of those. So I would put it in the category of just confronting sin. That is a shepherding task. That is definitely an aspect of caring for somebody's soul. So yes, that's a shepherding task, but one that I think has to be that, and then like raising up and training other elders, for example, or raising up and training other deacons is going to come more from that role of elders and deacons. I think church discipline falls into that category. So yeah, there's some places like that. I think, let me think of another. Yeah. Those are two definitely that stick out that you've highlighted that was even mentioned over here. Those two are definitely shepherding tasks. But again, I see those as not necessarily the place that you're going to have a broad lay leader leadership work from. So yeah, but those definitely elders and deacons leading out in those things would be the places that I would put those. Yeah, you're right. Thank you. Other questions, thoughts? Yeah, in the back. Here, all the way in the back, Ray, getting your workout today.
Sorry, Ray, that was quick. Just asking about how pastoral care works in your church, I guess, because there's overlap in terms of in our church, there's quite a few people in that weaker situation, struggles, but also there are people who need physical help. They're struggling with life in lots of different ways. So how does pastoral care work in your church? Is it that the deacons are doing stuff and then you've also got like a pastoral care team who are doing more pastoring? Just interested to know how that works.
Yeah, thank you. So once we finally got things in place, it took about 7 or 8 years. We got qualified elders in place and we had deacons in place who then understood their role is one of service, not authority, not necessarily primarily shepherding, but service. Once we did that, it really started working well together. And so let me just give, I'll give one example, and we can talk about more of these later if it would be helpful. But the elder, in fact, it even became a pattern where the elders would meet typically once a month on a Sunday afternoon. We'd meet, we'd have service and lunch as families. And then we'd send the families home and we'd meet for probably 4 hours as elders once a month because that was the best window for all these guys. And we'd meet for 4 hours. And during that 4 hour period, at some point, the deacons would be simultaneously meeting in another room. And so I would meet with the chairman of the deacons who would kind of lead that portion of their meeting beforehand. And we would just kind of talk about, what are y'all going to talk about? Here's kind of what we're going to talk about. And we would spend half of our meeting praying and talking about pastoral issues in the church. That was half of our, about close to 2 hours of our meeting was shepherding and praying for people. And out of that then came the needs that would spring up from that, from a spiritual standpoint. But also what would spring out of that is physical needs. Maybe we didn't realize that one of the other elders knew that we didn't. So we're compiling those things. And when if it was something of service to care for somebody else, I would connect up with the deacons after that meeting. And they would do the exact same thing. What's coming up for us as we're talking about how to serve people that we need to pass on to we need to let the elders know. Oh, I was at this widow's home, you know, fixing something in her kitchen, and she started to share with me that, you know, this tragic thing happened in her family. Nobody knew. The elders didn't know. Nobody told her. Well, there he comes to me after that meeting, go, did you know so-and-so's, you know, brother died or whatever it was? And we're like, wow, no, we didn't. So that's an example, just even from meeting in the same place, understanding our roles. And here's the key, not just understanding your role, but being for the other ones. to where you support their work and you and this give and take. And so one other example I'll give is we made a decision. We're going to spend, you know, this much money to do a renovation, you know, on the church or something like that. And we basically make the decision because we have the authority as elders to make that decision on how money's going to be spent, because that is an oversight issue. And then we go to the deacons and say, okay, we have $10,000 to do this renovation. And we kind of set the parameters. So go to it. And they go, great. $10,000. We got that to work with. Okay, go. And then there's the deacons. They go and do the renovation. They hire the contractors. They do the work themselves, whatever it is, but we're not doing that. And so just the give and take of working together like that was really a beautiful thing to experience. Before that, my first 3 years, as I said, I'm cleaning bathrooms. I'm dealing with all the contractors because nobody else is doing that. I'm doing all of that. So if you're doing a bunch of service tasks and you're an elder, that's okay. Sometimes nobody else can do it. My argument would be, if you're doing it 10 years later, there's probably a problem. Question asked during the break, but they wanted to ask it in private, but I wanted to repeat it publicly because I guarantee you that there are plenty of you wrestling with the same thing, and that is, how do you challenge people or call people or encourage people to serve in the church in different ways when everybody seems to be so busy, nobody has time to serve in these different ways? And what if you also, even as leaders, are stretched thin, so you even feel guilty asking people because you know you're struggling with the same thing? So a very, very thoughtful question. And here's a couple ways I would answer that question. One is, I think elders are called from 1 Peter 5 to prove to be an example to the flock. So if you're an elder and you're trying to raise up lay leaders and nobody seems to have time to serve in the church, you need to evaluate how much of an example you're showing, you're demonstrating to them of having your own capacity to be able to do things in the church or just have capacity in general for people. But the other is if you feel guilty about asking people to serve, I think that's where you want to go back to the text and let them embolden you, in a sense, to say, Titus 2, everybody's got a role. Everybody's got a role to play if you're in the body of Christ, if you follow Jesus, whatever that is in some small way, in some maybe just not spend a lot of time doing it, but it's something you can do. The third thing I would say is, I think this is why this is a shepherding piece. Helping people understand what their role is in the church, how they're gifted, how they might be able to serve in a certain area of the church, starts with just discipleship and shepherding one-on-one. I ask that question when I do membership interviews. I would do membership interviews with every person coming into the church. And that was one of the questions I would ask them before they're even a member. I would say, if you become a member, where do you see yourself serving in some way? And they may not have an answer, but what I did in that moment was I already put the category in their head of, yeah, I have no intention for you to come and sit. You know, I have intention for you to come and be cared for and to hear the word and to be a part of our church. But in a similar way, I mean, when we talk about church being a family, like everybody does their part, and to try to push that expectation, that is a culture thing. That is something that you can't do in 6 months. But it is an aspect of culture that you can establish. And that's one of the things I saw. There's two things I watched happen culturally in our church that happened over years that caused our church to thrive eventually. One of them was simply every membership interview, I had the opportunity, as they're coming into the church, to set the bar of what it means to be a member of our church. And that was part of it, just to put in their head, what I want you to pray and start thinking about how you might serve this body because at that point, there's a reason they're coming to join the church. And one of them probably was they felt loved and cared for and served by the church. And so it's a great opportunity in that moment to say, so when you become a member, how are you going to be a part of that and step up and serve? The second part culture, and that became a part of the culture of the church. The second part of the culture of the church that changed was how friendly and welcoming people were on Sunday mornings. It was not that case when I got there. But what started to happen as just a few of us became very zealous about welcoming and loving people on the in the front door, that started to become a reason why people were coming and wanting to stay at the church. And then what I started watching happen, again, it took years, but those people, as they were won to the church in those by those means, I started watching them before they even became members. They were being proactive and going and greeting visitors and meeting the new people because that's what somebody did with them. You really can, God really can, through the Holy Spirit, change the culture of your church. But it takes years and it takes a lot of intentionality about what you're trying to do in your church. It doesn't just happen. I believe that the Holy Spirit, in line with our intentionality of trying to pursue to be a biblical church, is the combination that God really blesses. But a lot of times I think we're not as intentional as we should be. So on that note, I think having those individual conversations with people, one by one by one, is how you encourage people to step up in a particular role. And as one person after the other begins to maybe serve in some small way, there is a trickle-down effect that comes with that. But I'm going to say something that I know you all know, but I want to be able to say it just for the record. There's only so much you can accomplish in this area from announcements from the pulpit. Where a lot of this work gets done is you're sitting across the table drinking tea. You're sitting in their living room and you say, you know, I noticed you're good at this. Did you know there's a need in the church that you actually might really be gifted to help with? You ever thought about that? You know, you're encouraging them in something you see in them and encouraging them maybe to step into the church to play that role. Well, you know, I just, work's busy and, you know, the kids are at a really busy season of life. I don't know if I can do that. Well, I tell you what, if I could find a way for you to be able to do it and it not take a lot of time, would you be open to me figuring out how to do that? And we could talk more. Now, he can say no at that moment, but he probably won't. He'll probably at least be open to a conversation at least. So the one-on-one organic conversations is a lot of times how you will equip lay leaders and even help them to see. So remember, keep this in mind. The lay leaders in your church, or the potential lay leaders in your church, you're just general church members. Don't assume they know how they're gifted and don't assume they know how they can be useful. Do not ever assume that. Your job as a shepherd is, as you get to know them, to be able to speak words of life, encouragements to them to help them maybe see something that they don't see. One of the really encouraging things I saw is to watch somebody who became an actual deacon in our church or became an elder in our church when they actually didn't see that at first, but just the encouragement of other people in their life. They saw that the church affirmed them in that and they begun to see maybe something in them that they didn't see before. That's really rewarding to see people step up into those lay leadership roles.